So we are continuing the discussion. Now, whenever I discuss the Oriental family values, like respect for grandparents or preserving the pedigree, the cultural heritage of a family, one big question that I had to encounter here and also in India, in some conferences, you know, is this. About 30 years back, grandparents decided what academic course the grandson or granddaughter should join in university. Not just marriage or other more important things. And what kindergarten you should choose. Grandparents and parents, of course, have the final word. Not now, of course, anymore. So, and this was true to more or less the same degree in countries like China and till about maybe 1960s, 70s in Japan and South Korea, of course, you know, India being much more conservative. But still, things have changed. Now, the question arises, if you respect, if you always consider the heritage of the family, the parental culture, as paramount, as something to be revered, to be preserved, then where do you draw the line? Now, you can just imagine, to draw a comparison, America, Australia, Canada, Germany, to some extent France, Britain, Sweden, Switzerland, all Protestant countries, more or less. You compare them with Southern European countries, Mexican countries, Spain, Italy, Argentina, Brazil. So where family culture is very strong, somehow they tend to be somewhat backward. They don't have the same highly evolved political institutions. Like, compare Russia with Britain. The higher democracy, the innovation, the readiness with which society introduced new enactments, amended their laws in British Parliament, all that. Now, so there is always a problem with tradition, with holding fast to one's own tradition. It could, not necessarily, but it could make you a bit conservative, rigid, and a tendency to reject innovation. You may have read the article. You know why Silicon Valley won the battle for information technology and electronics. Japan was the nation that initiated all the process. Japan lost the competition to Silicon Valley. Because in Silicon Valley or in America, more or less, you know, you can come up with any new idea and people, the government will support it, accept it. But not in a conservative country like Japan, which is really very perfectionist, disciplined, hardworking society, but very conservative. So there is always a problem with highly conservative societies. They are not as ready to change, to accept innovation, and to move forward. There is a lot of rigidity and a tendency to uphold, blindly follow an ancient tradition, sometimes in a very irrational way. So that's the problem. The other side also there is a problem, superficiality. Instead of going for the best, you interpret what you have as the best in the world. This may be all right in science, technology, management science, but not in values, social values, cultural values. So often, instead of going for the best, a tendency to interpret what we have as the best in the world. So, is it possible to blend harmoniously, without any friction, to blend the best of these traditional societies, best of, in a broader sense, we can say the Oriental, anti-Occidental. That's the words which Vivekananda used. Of course, that was long before this culture of innovation was initiated. Swami Vivekananda, while talking about, at that time it looked a bit utopian, a blending of the best of the Occidental and the best of the Oriental. And in a broader way, Swamiji said, in historical context, he put it, a blending of the best of the Greco-Roman and the best of the Eastern or Oriental. That's what he said. See the sense of sacredness, of sanctity, of the institution of family or institution of marriage. Respect for pedigree, respect for culture, tradition, which is so characteristic of ancient Oriental civilizations. You combine it, you blend it with the innovation, the freedom, the egalitarian spirit, the democratic spirit of, let us say, the modern American political experiment. Is it possible? That's what Swamiji really visualized more than 130 years back. He actually speaks about this. That was long before the very concept of a global society ever evolved. Now, I think this is happening unconsciously at different levels, in fact. If you can have a sense of sanctity, of sacredness, of the institution of family, and with all other aspects that go along with it, like in the institution of marriage, institution of vows, and feeling, well, we have a culture, heritage to preserve, and the confidence that comes along with that, plus the innovation, the freedom, the egalitarian spirit, minus its superficiality. And of course, minus the conservatism of the orthodoxy. That's what Vivekananda had in mind. So many sociologists and anthropologists, while criticizing the ancient Indian ways of life, especially casteism and all that, they used a very strong, almost is an invective, the tyranny of seniority, the tyranny of tradition. So a tradition need not be a tyrant. A tradition can be something that we can uphold. Tradition need not sit over our head with a big stick in his hand. Tradition can be something that we can that can be upheld and preserved. So that's the idea that we had to discuss in the afternoon session. Is it possible to be modern without being superficial? Nibbling and take every new idea that comes and immediately forget it, let it go. So that, on the other hand, rigid societies, conservative societies, keep the doors and windows shut, not willing to accept new ideas. And modern societies, with all the innovation, willing to accept every new idea, but then at a very superficial level. So, well, that's what Vivekananda had in mind. My understanding, from a sociological point of view, if he fully understands the true meaning of these four values and the important role played by the ideal of dharma, this blending is possible. It is not it's not a utopian concept. I mean, blending of the best of the Occidental, best of the Oriental. One can be traditional without being rigidly orthodox. I mean, without any change. And one can be modern without being very superficial. And innovation is possible without taking everything at a very superficial level and let it go next moment. So in this context, these four values, which in a way play a very important role in making life a totality, that means without any conflict between one's own individual spiritual practice and the role you may have to play in the family context, whatever the role may be. So dharma, in a way, helps as a great guide and philosopher. Now, what is dharma in this context? That's what we are going to discuss. So dharma involves two aspects. One, a great ideal, and also the ideal of righteousness. It is not righteousness as we understand in the ordinary sense. What is constitutionally right? The concept of dharma goes beyond what is constitutionally right. Because what is constitutionally right may not be really the right thing. Very often it could be about 70-80% of the cases. But very often, what is legally right may be morally wrong. It could happen. I can give the example of a great ancient Indian philosopher and author. He is perhaps one of the greatest authors of ancient India. His name was Vyasa. He was the author of Mahabharata. He was the one who made Vedas available in their present form. For example, you know, in the middle of 19th century, Max Müller took initiative to get all the four Vedas printed in book form. He was the one who played a major role in bringing out a standardized, modern edition of all the four Vedas. He played a very important role. Actually, he was commissioned to study the Vedas and translate the Vedas into German and English and make it popular among modern people, including Indians, to make them understand how absolutely ridiculous the Vedas are. And for that, he was commissioned by a group of different denominations, including the Anglican Church and Unitarians and others. So Unitarians were very broad-minded. But once he started reading the Vedas, he became a devotee of the Vedas. And he never looked back. He and his wife practically did not have a regular married life. And Vivekananda, while traveling in Europe, met him in Oxford. And when he met Max Müller, then Swamiji said, "This man could have been a reincarnation of the ancient Vedic Rishi Vasishtha and Arundhati." Both were great teachers, Vasishtha and Arundhati. That's what Vivekananda himself said, seeing them. And Swamiji asked him, "Have you been to India?" He said, "No. And if I go there, then you may have to bury me there. You will not come back." That's what he said. Now, coming to the subject, the whole point is, when you combine these two aspects, that is righteousness and the moral, what is morally right, what is constitutionally right and what is morally right, then you can call it dharma. So I'm coming to the story of this Vyasa. So Vyasa, as I said, you know, was the greatest author of ancient times. But he became depressed. The most reputed philosopher, the teacher of many other great saints and sages, he became depressed. And one day, he was sitting on the banks of River Saraswati. And at that time, another sage happened to pass by. And he happened to step into his hermitage, Vyasa's hermitage. And his name was Narada. So Narada was surprised. Why are you unhappy? Because you should, if there is anybody in the world who has a right to be happiness, it's you, because he was the most accomplished philosopher, saint, and author of those days. And he was unhappy. So Vyasa himself did not know the reason for his unhappiness. Is it possible, you know, for you to be unhappy even when you are the most accomplished person? Then that is the stage for higher evolution. In Vedanta, in Yoga Sutra, there is a name called Parinama Dukkha. parinama, tapa, samskara, dukkha. Four dukkha. Dukkha should not be taken in its dictionary meaning. Dukkha is a feeling of lack of inner completeness. Suppose you have got a wonderful job. You are the most respected person. Practically nothing going wrong with you. Still, if you feel there is something wrong with me, it is possible only for a highly evolved soul. A Buddha had it, and you know the result? He became Buddha. He was a prince born in a rich family. He was the son of a prince, a king, and was brought up in a condition of absolute luxury. So one day he was being taken out, the young prince, by his charioteer, and he found an old man, a sick man, and a dead body being taken on a procession to the funeral place. Suddenly the reality of old age, sickness, and death, which he had never even heard of, struck him. Because when he was born, there was a prophecy that one day he may become an emperor, a great emperor, a conquering emperor, or he may become an emperor among ascetics. One of these two options. So his father Suddhodana believed in astrology. So he wanted to make sure that this man doesn't become an ascetic at any cost. So he was not allowed to experience any kind of unhappiness. He was brought up in luxury. He was very rarely allowed to come out and see maybe the backward places, the slums, or any sign of poverty or unhappiness. But anyway, one day his father was away. At that time, his charioteer, he requested his charioteer, and he was being taken out on a chariot, and he saw the face of a sick man, old man, and also a dead body being taken to the funeral ground. So he was terrified. And that night he left his palace. A young wife and little baby had a last look and left his palace. Now it is not cruelty to family. We are talking about family culture. This is a higher evolution. When you are perfectly happy in an empirical sense, still you feel a desire for something higher, transcendental. Many people come to Vedanta Society and listen to these ideas because they have everything going on fine. Still they want to find out a higher meaning for life. Sometimes they're caught by the destiny and fate catching you by the throat and putting wisdom thrusting around your unwilling throat. It is a statement in a poem anyway. So what happened, he became a Buddha. And he walked 1,000 miles, sat under a tree with a strong determination. Ihasane sushyutu me shariram tugasti mamsam cha vilayam cha yadhu aprapya siddhim bahu janma durlabham naivasanat kaya matas chalishyate. Buddha's attitude as he walked 1,000 miles from his palace and sat under the tree under Buddhaya, where he got enlightenment. That his mindset is graphically described by the author of Lalita Vistara, which gives the history of biography of Buddha in poetical form. It is a book that belongs to maybe 2nd century AD. Let me sit under this tree, let my body perish, let my body be reduced to bones and marrow, still I won't get up from this seat without or before getting the highest spiritual wisdom. So he became Buddha. Now that was the case with Vyasa. Vyasa was the most highly accomplished person, the author, the philosopher, the saint, the wise man of those days. But he felt an inner what we call discontentment. It's called parinama dukkha. So that's why in the Vyasa's commentary on, Vyasa himself wrote a commentary on Patanjali Yoga Sutras about parinama dukkha, yoginam eva krishnadi. It happens only to yogis, highly evolved souls. Then Narada asked him, what's the matter with you? So Vyasa said, somehow I feel a kind of inner discontentment. So this inner discontentment, it is not a kind of miserable feeling of being wretched. There is a blissfulness that goes along with this inner discontentment. It is not the wretchedness or the sadness or misery of a person suffering from a material problem. Because if you are really worried about higher ideas, then along with that worry, there is also an inner blissfulness when you go in search of a higher goal in life. So Narada told him, well, you wrote all these wonderful books. And what you wrote was dharma only in its lopsided sense. That is, you should do this, you should not do this. More like a constitution. But you did not recommend a definite ideal for one's complete life. You have not explained how one should guide and lead one's life based on dharma towards the highest spiritual goal. That you didn't explain. Because as I mentioned, you know, Mahabharata has got hundreds of characters. And hundreds of characters, I've got hundreds of views. There are long dialogues, as I said, you know, more than 100,000 verses. Hundreds of characters, description of scores of dynasties and so on. So there are many contradictory ideas, you know, different characters giving their own arguments and philosophical ideas. But you didn't explain, you didn't pinpoint what should a spiritual seeker do. What's the royal road to the highest spiritual enlightenment? That you did not explain. So that was the lopsidedness of Mahabharata. So he wrote Bhagavata Purana, that subject. Now, dharma in its complete form, as I mentioned, has two elements. First, what is morally right and also what is constitutionally right. What society expects you to do, and also, what is the right thing for you to do, independent of whether it's constitutionally right or wrong. Both should be the same. That is dharma. So once we regulate our whole life and actions according to the principles of dharma, then it is possible to combine the finest fruits of Western egalitarianism, the openness and freedom of social life, the complete absolute freedom from prejudices or privileges or all these, you know, cobwebs of ancient social orders based on inherited prejudices. Maybe it is maybe the House of Lords and also maybe the casteism of India or maybe the privileges of ancient Russian Orthodox Church. All these you can. All inherited traditions and conventions which block a society's forward march. So how can combine this innovation, modernism, freedom, egalitarianism, and the finest aspects of a traditional society which values family life, institutional family, which considers, which also attributes, which gives a sense of sacredness and sanctity, which attaches an idea of sanctity to human relationship. For a dharma is necessary. So once you regulate our life according to the principles of dharma, what happens is, at one stage, even when you become the richest person in the world, what you call artha, means for enjoyment, you have accomplished enough. But without deviating from the path of dharma, then what happens? Something happens to us. We realize the transitoriness of worldly enjoyments. So that's an interesting thing. If we stick to dharma and live in this world, then that pattern of life takes us to the next stage of evolution. we realize the transitoriness, the perishable nature of all worldly achievements. And that is called Parinama Dukkha, really speaking, which Buddha had. It is possible only for a very noble, highly evolved person to feel unhappy when he has no material wants. When he has already... It's not that one should wait for all material pleasures to be enjoyed. Not that means. I mean, when you don't have any attachment, when you don't have any desire for material things, and also you have a sense of goal for higher purpose. So there are two aspects. One, we move towards a higher goal. It is not just running away from something lower. It is a positive movement towards the higher. So this should be understood very clearly. See, you can move to the west just blindly moving away from the east. And you can also move to the west without thinking whether you are moving from the east or not. So it is not running away from something unpleasant. Rather, it is moving towards something that is superior and higher. This is possible when we follow the path of dharma in family life. Otherwise, family life can be a terrible chain, maybe made of gold, but still a chain. Still it could be bondage. If you find it difficult to go to a church or a temple to pray because you're the other side, the other family member, no, you won't go there. You'll go for a movie or nightclub. Then it becomes a bondage, even for spiritual freedom. So that's also happened. So family structure, the institution of family life, can be a bondage. As I said, it may be made of gold, maybe golden chain, but still binds us. Otherwise, family life itself opens the doors for freedom when we follow the path of dharma. And as I mentioned, when we follow the path of dharma in our pursuit of artha and kama, material desires, then what really happens at one stage, you start moving towards a higher goal. That's called moksha. Moksha is the word used in Sanskrit, means liberation. So dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. These are the four core fundamental values that should guide our family life. If you leave out moksha, then you'll be stuck in artha and kama. So I use the word Sanskrit, you know, because artha means any instrument, any tool, any means for achieving anything could be called artha, but in this particular context, it means artha for achieving worldly pleasures. One can enjoy worldly pleasures. In fact, the Vedic scheme of life not only allows, but even clearly encourages that every householder should strive to make money and wealth through dharmic means. There was a misplaced emphasis on glorified poverty. Unfortunately, in India also it happened. But it is a slight deviation. So I should tell you one joke. It should be understood only in its limited context. You know, Mahatma Gandhi was the greatest man India has ever produced. He was a successful, highly educated barrister. And you read Encyclopedia Britannica about his. He was a wonderful man. So when he entered Indian freedom struggle, he dressed himself as a mendicant. But it's morally for the masses. So in India, if you go about wearing the best Italian-made suits and then talk for the poor people, they won't accept you. You should be poor, apparently, at least. So, anyway, this man, Gandhi, became poor in his dress code, everything. So once it so happened that, you know, Gandhi was traveling and he got down, then, you know, Gandhi won't drink cow milk. So he'll drink only goat milk. So it so happened that his followers had to go in search of a goat And it's very difficult. You have to travel a long distance to get goat milk in a village. And that means so many people should be engaged in the old, their jeeps or some vehicles. They went in search of goat milk. So Lord Mountbatten was the viceroy at that time, just after the Second World War. He said, how much it cost to keep the old man poor? Because to keep Gandhi's poverty, so in fact the exact statement is, how much it cost the state exchequer to keep the old man poor, the old language used. How much it cost to the state exchequer to keep the old man poor. To maintain his poverty, they have to spend a lot of money. So in fact, sometimes, you know, due to the influence of Jaina religion, there was a misplaced emphasis on artificial poverty in India, which is really a sirsasana, headstand of the real Vedic ideal. And you stand on your head, not on your feet, opposite, the inversion. But really speaking, according to Vedic ideal, every householder should work hard through proper means, acquire wealth, not for material enjoyment. That is also part of the scheme for householders' life, for preserving the family, the children, pay the taxes to the king, and support the society. This is part of the system. That's why, you know, Sri Ramakrishna scolded Azra. Gandhi himself was one of the greatest devotees of Sri Ramakrishna. You know, he was the one who wrote a most memorable foreword to the first edition of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. As Gandhi said, reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna enables us to see God face to face. And even so, great devotee, was a great spiritual man. So what I want to say is, every householder has a duty to acquire wealth and all necessary means for living a happy material life in this world. The only difference is, when he sticks to the ideal of dharma, at a later stage, he realizes that there is something higher than material life. It is not the highest goal. It is fine, but that's not the highest goal. There is something higher. That transcendental value is called moksha. In Sanskrit, literally it means liberation from the cycle of this continuing cyclic rotation of birth, life, rebirth, and continuing this. I mean liberation from ignorance and liberation from all wants. What Buddha called nirvana, which is the end, which is the liberation from pratitya samutpada, the cyclic, you know, rotation, 12-stage cyclic rotation. The same nirvana is called moksha in Vedantic tradition. But this happens only when we stick to the principles of dharma. So the question arises, where does the sanctity, the ideal of sanctity of family values play an important role in this? Without family values, you won't be able to stick to dharma. That's the main problem. If a family member detaches himself or herself from the family culture, then what is left out is a voidness, an emptiness. You are in a vacuum. Otherwise, you feel you are in distinguished company. How? Because you remember your culture. Your grandparents, great-grandparents, all the struggles that your ancestors may have gone through to make your life happy right now. So you feel yourself, you are in the company of a great number of ancestors. And also you are the inheritor of a great heritage, which is sacred, which belongs to us. As I mentioned, you know, in the morning, you feel you have a treasure that belongs to you. And that will save you from any feeling of depression, wretchedness. Otherwise, if we forget the past, we can't have a future. If we detach ourselves from the past, from our pedigree or heritage, then how can we have a future? We won't be able to build a future. So, to accommodate these values, the ancient Vedic sages evolved a scheme of life, which is technically called Chaturasrama, which means four stages in the evolution of individual life. Four stages. First stage, we already mentioned this morning, the convocation address, Vedam, Anuchi, Acharya, Andayavasinam, Anishasti, Satyambada, Dharmanchara. We mentioned, a Vedic teacher addresses a group of students who have completed 12 years of education in a hermitage and ready to depart, return to their homes to start their life as husband or wife, as and playing multiple roles in the family setting. So what they should stick to. So Satyambada, you should speak the truth, and Satyana Pramadidavyam, you should not deviate from the path of Satya. Practice Dharma, and you should not deviate from the path of Dharma. Then there is one word, you know, I can just read some of these interesting thing, you know, which I mentioned already. There is a So, Deva Pitru Karya Abhyana Pramadidavya Matru Devo Bhava Pitru Devo Bhava Acharya Devo Bhava Aditi Devo Bhava. And then there is something very interesting. Yani Anavadhyani Karmani Tani Sevidavyani. Means, the teacher tells the student, now you have stayed in this Vedic hermitage. You have seen how things are going on here. You also read, studied a lot of things, the scriptures. Accept those which you consider to be admirable, worth of emulation. So that's something, yani anavadhyani karmani tani sevidavyani no itarani. That which are higher, worthy of not imitation, but you should imbibe, worthy of emulation. Those which you consider to be worthwhile, useful, that you follow. No, Idrani, those things which you could not understand the value of. There are many things which you may not have fully understood or appreciated, but don't bother. Whatever you appreciated, that you follow. And then, no, Idrani, Anyway, then there is a very interesting thing. Satyana Pramadidavyam, Dharmana Pramadidavyam, Kushalana Pramadidavyam, Bhutena Pramadidavyam, Swadhyaya Pravajanabhyamna Pramadidavyam. See, it means, you should not deviate from any obligation or work which may be necessary to make your family prosperous. That's an interesting thing. Bhuti. So sometimes, you know, there is a, as I mentioned, misplaced notion that Vedanta is a life-negating ideal or cult of over-asceticism. The truth is the farthest from it. So Vedanta integrates, as I mentioned, the needs and demands of life in this world. It just gives you a higher idea and doesn't leave you there. It also gives you a ladder. You can climb up to the higher idea. So, and not only that, if there are a few things to be done, duties and responsibilities, which are necessary for your household life, you should not neglect them. The Kushalana Pramadavya means Shankaracharya says Atmirakshanartha Karmanakana Pramadavya. So we have to do certain things for your preservation of your family. Don't be indifferent or negligent. So on the one hand, you find a kind of a very high ideal of dynamism, realism, accommodating all the practical needs of life in this world. And at the same time, the highest idealism. So, moksha is not presented for all at the beginning itself. That is another idea. See, we read about liberation. We talk about liberation. Sometimes question arises, the world is relative, the world is not the absolute reality. Worldly things are not real. Worldly things are perishable, transitory. Does it mean we should run away from the world? No. That's what the teachers say. You should not run away from your duties and responsibilities. You should not even run away from those duties and obligations which are necessary for you to bring enough wealth for the preservation of your family. I cannot give a more graphic example than quoting the Hazra episode. Sitamakshna, who cannot touch a coin with his hand, and he was always immersed in samadhi, highest contemplation of God, asked a devotee of God, at least wanted to be a devotee, but he had neglected his duties and responsibilities to his family, to his parents, to his children and wife, and ran away from there, running away. He was running away from it. He was not moving towards a higher goal. That's what I mentioned earlier, you know. It is not just running away from something lower, but it is positive, moving towards something higher. So that should be understood. Hazra was just running away from his family. He may have read in books. He knew a little bit of Vedanta. He had read in books or this family, all these things, worldly pleasures are not the ultimate goal of human life. That much he knew. But so he thought running away from them, going away from them, or escaping them was the way for spiritual liberation. No. There is no scope for escaping, running away from. Rather, it was running towards a higher goal. And this running towards a higher goal is possible without running away from the world of realities. So that's why facing the unreality of material pleasures without running away from them, but by going towards a higher goal, that is the scheme of these four stages of life and four values. So I mentioned Brahmacharya Ashrama, the first stage. And then when such a person who has studied and listened to all these instructions, convocation address, as I mentioned, when he goes to his home, it is called Samavartana, means Sammik Avartana, means returning or coming back to his own home after proper instruction. Then he marries. So he's trained to be an ideal husband or ideal wife or ideal parents, whatever may be. And then he leads an ideal life, an householder. Now, when an householder leading a proper life, looking after family obligations, without running away, but moving towards a higher goal, as I mentioned, when he reaches a particular stage, a Manu says, you know, Grihastasu yada pasyed vali palida matmanaha apatyasi apatyam tada aranyam samasyed. Manusmriti, belonging to 14th century BC, is supposed to be a great legal code, one of the oldest legal code, which lays down rules and regulations for integrating family life and spirit, one's own individual spiritual life. So Manu makes a statement as a recommendation for all householders in today's times. Literal meaning is this: an householder, when he finds that his face is getting wrinkled, hair is getting gray, and when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, he should not remain at home, in modern language, making a pest of himself. Sometimes they use that. I read this in an article by an ultra-modern sociologist. You know. He should leave his home, or they should leave both husband and wife, and stay in a place spending the rest of their lifetime in contemplation. Not, of course, you know, in those days, in 14th century BC, when Manu wrote this, there were plenty of forests. It's not the case today. So literal meaning is this. If you read the translation, it becomes the sixth chapter, mostly sixth chapter, second verse of Manu Smriti. We can get translations. Grihastas तु यदा पश्येद् वली पलिदम् आत्मनः अपत्यस्य अपत्यं तदा अरण्यं समासीत्. सो वेन् एन हाउसहोल्डर फाइंड्स हिमसेल्फ गेटिंग एजेड, फेस गेटिंग रिंकल्ड एंड हेयर गेटिंग ग्रे, instead of struggling to whiten his teeth and blacken the hair, what he should do, the husband and wife should retire to a place of contemplation, solitude, and spend the rest of the lifetime in meditation. Now, for your information, maybe about 70-75% of all the great authors and writers of Upanishads and Vedic scriptures were such retired householders. You know, the Sandipani was living in a forest hermitage, teaching Lord Krishna. Vasishta, Uddalaka, the teacher of Shvetaketu in Chandogya Upanishad, all of them were retired householders. So they spent the rest of their lifetime in a solitary place, in meditation, teaching the scriptures, helping the new generation to learn scriptures. So many of the meditative methods, vidyas, were all evolved by them. In modern times, let us say, old age homes can be a wonderful place for retired householders. Instead of watching Terminator 1, 2, 3, 4, as they often do, which I went to one of the old age homes in 2012 twice, and I found one staff member came and changed the CD, Terminator 1 over, Terminator 2 started. So a lot of fighting and shooting I heard. I looked at the big TV screen. So instead of that, maybe the great householders can spend their lifetime in meditation, in contemplation, thinking of higher things, and perhaps giving a helping hand to the new generation. So that is the beauty of this system, the scheme of life. This, in a different way, can be practiced even in modern times. It is being done in some places, you know, meditation, all these things are being taught. So in a distant way, these things are being implemented in many places. So third stage of human life. It's a gradual evolution. First, you are a student. So you learn how to be an ideal member of a family, member of society, and a citizen of the country. And then you become a responsible householder, and then you retired. So this is the third stage called Grihastasana, means the stage of householdership. In modern times, you find, I have seen myself, wonderful devotees who associate with Vedanta societies, practically living like the ancient Vanaprasthins. They have attachment, but only to limited extent, spending most of the time and energy for higher spiritual goal. By doing this, on the one hand, we are evolving. Secondly, society is benefited. So when society is benefited through our unselfish work, we are also evolving. So this is a third stage in human life. So on the one hand, these four core values of the Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. On the other hand, the four stages of human life. Studentship, householder, then retirement age. Fourth stage is sannyasa, which is difficult to implement as such today. It literally meant in those days, ancient times, those who live a solitary life, both retired husband and wife, in a solitary place, contemplation and meditation, teaching higher things, enriching themselves and enriching society, they become mendicants. Now, this literally happens. You can see this happening. People who spend long years doing some unselfish deed, spending their own time, their own money, their own efforts, for higher purposes, sharing the burden for higher spiritual purposes, you know. Slowly, they evolve. So our actions play a very important role in our own spiritual evolution. It's not that our mind influences actions, but our actions also influence the mind. If we go on doing higher deeds, thinking of higher thoughts, the later you find your actions also evolve. And as you go on doing higher things, any noble deed, any unselfish act, any action as an offering to God expands and purifies and refines our personality. Because the mind gets more and more refined. Mind is full of tendencies, impressions, what we call vrittis, vasanas and samskaras. This is called karma vritti chakram in Patanjali scheme. We do something, whatever we do will leave a residual element. It creates a ripple, an influence, an impression in our mind. It becomes a samskara, a strong tendency. The samskaras become also again an action-oriented tendency, vasanas. That prompts us to similar actions in future. So, and actions again produce impressions, samskaras. So it goes on rotating. So when we do unselfish deeds, noble deeds, what happens is a lot of positive samskaras, a lot of positive spiritual wealth is created in the mental system. Sometimes we are not aware of it. Some people, after doing a lot of unselfish deed, noble deed for things, they complain, we are not progressing. You know, there's a problem. We have progressed a lot, so we are not able to recognize, feel the distance we have traveled. Sometimes it happens. From 0 to 1 is a long distance. But from 1 to 5, it is not a long, it's a longer distance, but we don't feel it. From 0 to 1, suddenly we have a radical transformation. Suddenly we get inspired by a great idea. And suddenly there's a change in our life. We feel a great impact. Then after practicing some higher spiritual ideals, after some years we feel we are not making progress. Actually, we have made a lot of progress because after reaching some level of spiritual progress, when we go further, we don't feel the distance that we are traveling. That's why from 0 to 1, we feel a long distance. But from 3 to 10, it's a really longer distance, but we don't feel that way. So what really happens is, if we continually go on doing noble deeds, going practicing higher ideas, slowly, the wisdom, the spiritual maturity that comes to a monk or a mendicant or a nun, it's called sannyasa, means moksha, means it automatically comes to a person. So sannyasa or mendicancy is a state of human spiritual evolution. It is not just a formal conferring something on, somebody makes you declare you a saint, you become a saint. No, saint is the state of human spiritual evolution. It is not a degree that you get from Stanford or from the Pope, really speaking. So the whole idea of, so that's why you have to remember, when you read the life, you find brahmacharyasama, grihasthasama, vanaprastha, sannyasa. Studentship, next, householdership, third, retirement stage. Fourth is mendicancy is mentioned. Means sannyasa, the state of a monk or a nun. That is a state of human spiritual evolution which automatically, inevitably happens to you when you live a contemplative life and also doing noble deeds, noble thoughts, noble words, unselfish actions. So, gradually we evolve. So that is what is called sannyasa. So this is a very high ideal of integrated life that Vedic sages planned in ancient times. Four values and four stages of human evolution. So again, as I mentioned, it is a state of individual spiritual progress. It is not a status that is conferred upon you, rather it's a state of spiritual evolution that we automatically reach as a result of our own spiritual evolution. So perhaps I started with was how to evolve a society which is free from the tyranny of tradition, orthodoxy and conformity and conservatism, which is characteristic of oriental societies, and also equally free from the superficiality, nibbling debate, and interpreting what you have as the best in the world instead of going for the best, which is characteristic of a modern Western trend. We don't mind by being blunt about it. Now you can have interaction. You can disagree from me. I would rather encourage you to express your disagreement instead of agreeing with me. That'd be helpful for conversation and discussion. Thank you. Now we have half an hour interaction.
Swamiji, I know some families from India, and in conversation they'll tell me about how their children don't obey them. Their children are born in America.
Excuse me, could you repeat once more?
Sure. I know families who have children, they're Indian families, and they're raising their children in America. These parents were raised in India, and they're used to doing what their parents told them to do. And they're saying here in America, that isn't happening.
Yeah. Yes. I had to address a group of students. The majority of them belong to these categories. And what I mentioned, children of Indian parents imitating American ways is doubly suicidal because, an average American can take many of the so-called tragedies in his stride. See, average American is very confident. He's not easily shaken. See, the CEO of a company, if he loses the job today, tomorrow he'll go to Trader Joe's and start packing for $30 per hour. An Indian, if he loses his highly prestigious job, he may be disowned by his own family, including his own parents. What are you doing? You're good. I mean, you now don't have a job. An American will be proud to say, I'm a barber. I'm a gardener. In India, they will be very apologetic to say, I'm a gardener. There is such a ridiculous, in fact, I'm also not free from this, to be very frank. The dignity of labor as a social practice is unknown in many of the Oriental countries. Because Chinese culture got a terrible shock during this called Cultural Revolution. Everything was uprooted. So they lost a lot of their cultural wealth. Perhaps India, this continuing for the last 8,000 years. So what happens, dignity of labor, the willingness to take risk, which are characteristic of every American, is not found among Indians. Indian CEO loses his job, tomorrow you won't find him working in Trader Joe's for $10 per hour. But the American CEO will easily do that. What happened to Apple CEO? He started a new empire. So that kind of innovation, the ability to take risks, that may go well with indifferent attitude towards parents, because every youngster can stand on his two feet, which is really not possible for their Indian counterparts. So there is always a problem in this. So very often, every nation in this world, every society in this world has its own unique wealth, cultural wealth, treasure. So every nation, India has got their own inherited cultural treasure. America has also evolved a unique cultural wealth, mostly inherited from the Greek or European tradition. But it's much less conservative, much less orthodox than European society. In Britain also, a member of the House of Lords won't go to Trader Joe's and start packing. Same as India. True that. So the whole point is, America has evolved its own unique social patterns. which is characterized by innovation, willingness to take risk, go anywhere, do any job, and be proud of it, which is not found in their Indian counterparts. So if they lose their wealth, they won't be gaining, they won't be imbibing the positive aspects of American, their American counterparts. So it will be a kind of cultural bankruptcy, the end result. So, but I think it is happening. So each cultural pattern has its own uniqueness about it, positive aspects. So what I was, again, it's a utopian, semi-utopian. What I mean, if you can combine innovation, the risk-taking tendency, the egalitarian spirit, the high dignity of labor, which are the characteristics of American society, plus the respect for parents of India. You know, so that's interesting. This is, again, an ideal. It is not a reality. Maybe in some places it may be becoming a reality. I don't know. You may be better informed than me.
So you're seeing a silver lining.
I think it is still evolving.
Thank you, Maharaj. This is, again, the search for truth, the orthodoxy and modernity.
Yeah.
And present time, Dr. Houston Smith, who just passed away recently, he traveled all over the world and studied different religions.
Yeah.
And he went to Japan to study Zen Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And his teacher asked him the question, they give him something to contemplate upon. And the question was, does a dog have a Buddha nature?
Does God have a Buddha nature?
Dog.
Who asked this question?
His teacher.
Japanese
teacher. Yeah. So the question is, what is that Buddha nature of it? Is the consciousness?
Yeah. The word Buddha nature is used to mean serenity, poise, balance, not being shaken, affected by anything. That's the Buddha nature. The word is often used as an adjective, sometimes even as a verb, sometimes a noun. Mm-hmm. I mean, to mean the tranquility, the even-mindedness, the poise, the balance, which you associate with Buddha's, you know, Buddha's image. So that's what it's called. Because Zen Buddhists, Zen, they had these meditation practices at all levels. So it conserves the energy, and it's, they say, according to Suzuki, it enabled the Japanese to conserve the national social energy on one focus and make progress rapidly without much conflicts. The Buddha practice of Zen Buddhism and contemplation of Buddha nature. Right.
But it's still a search for truth, right? I mean, looking for, yes. What is the real?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, really. Buddha, the word Buddha means the enlightened one. Mm-hmm. So higher spiritual enlightenment. So the word Buddha nature can also mean enlightenment. And for an enlightened person, this poise, balance, not being easily shaken by the external conflicts, circumstances.
Like our way of thinking, like everything has a consciousness, right? Like a tree, for vegetables have consciousness, animals have consciousness.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing?
Yes, the experience of oneness with the universal consciousness, which enables you to eradicate all kinds of distinctions and differences, feeling one with the whole creation, the whole nature, which gives you a very deep, profound sense of inner peace and poise. That's what. Yeah. Thank you.
You mentioned the four stages, but you also mentioned these four qualities of artha, dharma. And the moksha was at the end.
Four values.
Core values. Yeah. Artha, dharma. I didn't get the fourth one. Moksha.
Yeah, I'll explain. Yeah, these are four fundamental values of Vedic scheme of life. Four fundamental values. The first value is dharma, which means righteousness, It's a guiding value, guiding principle. The second one is artha, means means, tools for acquiring things necessary for this life. Kama means desire, fulfillment of desire, fulfillment of desires. The last one, the fourth one, is moksha or liberation. Also means higher transcendental value, can be equated to spiritual enlightenment. Yeah, that's the idea. These are the four values, right?
When we were speaking about the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, yeah, we give so much emphasis to the awakened one,
yeah,
but what about the tree?
Yes, the tree, at least in traditional Buddhist biographies, the tree doesn't play a major role. Buddha sat under the tree. He walked for a long distance, and while traveling, he met with many sages and wise men. Finally, he reached what is now called Buddh Gaya in Bihar, and there he sat under a tree. There's a river nearby, because it is said that you should practice your austerities and penance and meditation in a place that is calm, where there's river water nearby. So he sat under the tree, and the biographer puts these words into Buddha's mouth. But I read, ihasane sushyudu me shariram tugasti mamsam ce vilayam chiyatuhu aprapi siddhim bhujanma durlabham naivasanat kaya matas chalishire. Buddha took a vow. My body won't shake, move away from this seat. And then that's the last sentence, last line. Beginning, he says, I'm going to sit under this tree. Let my body be reduced to bones and marrow. Literally what means. Still, I won't move away from this seat before I get the highest spiritual enlightenment, which is possible only by effort running into several lives. That's the literal translation. Yes.
You spoke of discontentment. What about divine discontentment?
Divine, yeah. In fact, there are two types of contentment, you know. One is what I call parinama dukkha, which I mentioned, which naturally comes to some evolved souls, highly enlightened souls, but not those who have reached the highest goal, those who are highly evolved. See, even to feel that there is a higher thing for you to achieve, in spite of your achievement, happy state of affairs in this world, to have that kind of aspiration, you should be an evolved person. An average human being who is totally unevolved, maybe looking for a better job, few more billions of dollars, higher status, and things like that. But suppose you have got everything, still, instead of trying to expand your empire, worldly empire of wealth, I don't bother much. Is there something higher for me to achieve? To have that aspiration is a kind of inner, it is rooted in what we call a kind of divine inner discontent. Because that's a prelude to higher progress, which Buddha had, which in a way all spiritual seekers have. Very often we don't express it or we don't interpret it in this technical language. But all spiritual seekers have this inner discontentment, which is a sign of higher growth, which means we in a higher evolution. As I mentioned, you know, at the biological level, we are evenly evolved. Well, cultural, spiritual level, we belong to different levels of evolution. So this discontentment is the beginning of higher evolution. So Buddha nature, what Mr. Ratnakar mentioned, is the state of having reached that goal. That also is a kind of contentment. It's higher, it is supreme contentment. So from divine discontentment, we evolve to at the highest liberation or contentment, divine contentment. That's it. We wonder.
So, Swami, if we don't have enough discontent, you have mentioned before, from the Gita, I think it is, that to those, to my devotees, I send obstacles. Is that what we have to wait for?
Not necessarily. See, even if you have obstacles, how you react to that obstacles depends upon where you stand, what's your stage of evolution. See, people who have got a lot of problems, they take to alcohol. They go to so many other places. They go to Yosemite or Hawaii or what, and nothing beyond that. So there everything ends. But instead of, or along with that, maybe along with that, you also turn to some higher values. So there is misery is not a necessary ingredient. See, that particular verse is not from Gita. The verse which I quoted in the earlier session is not from Gita, not today, but some earlier. That is, the literal meaning of the verse is this. If you are a true devotee of God, who have done a lot of spiritual practice in previous life, and you have evolved, but for some reason, in this life, you happen to forget it, and you become too much attached to wealth and money, placing money above everything, or status, then what God does out of his compassion for you, if he wants to show his blessing to you, what he does? He takes away all your wealth. And if you are too much proud of your huge following, reputation, he gets you isolated from your people. And then you are forced to open your eyes. This you find in the lives of a great man like Yam, for example, the chronicler of the Gospel of Siddhamushna. It's a classic example. In his case, you know, his fate forcibly turned him to Siddhamushna, which is the beginning of spiritual progress. But, you know, even for that to happen, you should have evolved. Otherwise, instead of going to Vedanta society, instead of reading to the church, or instead of turning to prayer or meditation for higher values, people go to so many other places. Often they want to forget and run away from that problem. They don't want to solve the problem. See, people want to solve the problem by running away from them with the disastrous consequences. But those who have the spiritual boldness, courage, they want to find an answer to their problem. They go for higher values. So that is divine discontentment. The verse is, okay.
So you talked about Harza. What's his name? Harza. Hazra.
Hazra. Right?
So Hazra was in the mandir. He was in the temple with Ramakrishna. And, you know, how come Hazra was thrown out saying, go take care of your family?
He was not thrown out.
He was lectured upon.
Yeah. I should explain this.
You know, like Buddha was, he was a prince. He left.
I know. Yeah. Okay. Good question. Now, you know, Sri Ramakrishna knew Hazra was not moving towards a higher goal. He was running away from his duties and responsibilities. Very often this happens to many people. Maybe not in a highly competitive, active society like here. People will consider something wrong with you. But at least till about 50, 60 years back in India, people sometimes interpret spirituality as a way of running away from the world of realities. And in Hazra, Sri Ramakrishna understood that Hazra saw some good qualities. See, instead of going elsewhere, he came to the temple and sat there. But then he was not really there was an element of hypocrisy about him, because he was also telling some devotees, oh, the Ramakrishna, you come here, I shall teach you. He wanted to draw rich devotees so that he will get some extra money. And also he was indirectly playing the role of a marriage broker. So many multiple roles he was playing. So Sri Ramakrishna understood everything. At the same time, his wife and children were suffering, starving in the family. So his own mother sent a messenger to Sri Ramakrishna. Please tell Pratap to come here. I just want to see him. He need not give me anything. So Sri Ramakrishna understood. Now remember, if you completely forget or neglect your very important duties and responsibilities, in the name of spirituality, you cannot be spiritual. Impossible. If you have got a duty to your family or near and dear ones, people whose responsibility is yours, and if a person completely neglects that, apparently pretending to be going for something, that won't work that way. See, you have to. So for Hasra was concerned, looking after his family members and children was much more important than sitting somewhere and doing japa. Hasra's prayers won't be listened to by God if Hasra neglects his own duties and responsibilities to his children and family. So one cannot neglect one's own important duties and responsibilities. So that's why, as I mentioned earlier, you know, spirituality is not running away from something, it is moving towards something. Yeah, Buddha was moving towards something. So positive movement towards a higher goal is what takes you to higher spiritual level, transcend moksha or liberation. Not just running away from something. Running away from something, you may go elsewhere. That's why it is not just running away from the east, but rather it is moving positively towards the west. That is spiritual life. That's what exactly Lord Krishna tells Arjuna. Running, that is spirituality is not running away. That's why Vyadha did not run away from his meat market. He was cutting meat, distributing meat, satisfying his customers. That became a spiritual practice for him. And he became a teacher of the ascetic. The housewife whom he met was not spending her time in a temple. She had her old parents, her own husband and children. She was looking after them. And they were all living a family content life. That made her great, spiritually great. So spirituality is not something that we acquire just by praying to God alone. That maybe that's a line of demarcation. You see, in Vedantic spirituality, a place of worship or a formal allegiance to an anthropomorphic God is not an essential factor in Vedanta. If you become, you can become spiritual if you become unselfish, broad-minded, do your duty, then all the characteristics of a Buddha will come to you without running away and sitting under a tree. That's what happened to Vyadha, mentioned in the meat seller, and also the housewife. But remember, does it mean that one need not go to a temple? So in the Mahabharata, there are other contexts where it is mentioned that Vyadha, the great teacher, himself had gone into solitude and practiced meditation for long years. But then even after that, he did not take up another job. So dignity of labor you find of a very exalted type. There is spiritual content in that. So Vyadha himself practiced meditation in forest, in solitude. But then when he reached a higher level of spiritual progress, he didn't feel I should take up a higher job. No, he didn't do that. He continued his job, which was his father's job. That's Mahabharata story was like.
So Swamiji, my question is, so somebody does all this work, right? All this hard work, and we eventually get to this place of feeling bliss or happiness, Satchitananda, you know, the experience of Brahman or Atman in us, and then we die, then what happens?
Well, you know, yes, in Vedanta, they call liberation or moksha means, you see, it's a jivatma, called individual soul, has to go through different life cycles, doing different performing duties, doing different work, and acquiring samskaras and impressions, and based on that, again, being reborn. So the moment you step aside this flow of natural instinctive evolution, and you start thinking, what's the purpose of human life? What's the meaning of life? What's the nature of God? And if you practice, and as a result of this, maybe in several lives, if you reach that goal, then the cycle comes to an end. Then you become one with the universal reality. That is called nirvana in Buddhism. You see, there is almost identical. In Buddhism, it only stops with the end of the cycle. But in Vedanta, it goes beyond that. It becomes one with the universal reality.
Is it burning in the spirit world as well? Or
no. There is no more spirit world. You become one with the all-pervading supreme reality. Go.
Talking about duty and the sense of duty and immersing oneself in one's duty and applying and it becoming a spiritual experience, there are people who I think most would agree have some pretty horrible duties. Torture people, kill people. But they are performing their duties to the best of their own efforts. How is one to think of this?
Well, you know, when we become spiritually enlightened, there are two aspects that express our attitude in our interaction with others. One, whatever we do for others won't be harmful to them. Second, when we do that, we also feel a kind of inner tranquility and peace. Both together is possible only for those who are highly evolved. See, there are people who are very efficient. So efficiency in action, professional efficiency, mechanical efficiency, there is something spiritual about it. But that efficiency, if it is combined with the feeling of inner tranquility, peace, and inner blissfulness, then there is a spiritual element in it. In fact, that is the science of karma yoga mentioned in the Gita, third chapter. So there is a verse in the Gita, Saktaha karmani avidvamso yatha kurvanti bharada kuryan vidvan tatha asaktaha chigishugu lokasangrikam. This is meaning of fourth chapter. The idea is this, you know, what's the difference between these two people? On the one hand, we have one person who is very efficient, very successful, but very much attached, a lot of anxiety, neurosis, depression, sleeping pills, diabetes, BP, and so on. And also plenty of efficiency and success, a lot of money in the bank, successful person, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's another person who shows the same level of efficiency, enthusiasm, equally effective, but is totally detached. So what the difference between these two categories is, one person is attached. Attachment, when you are attached to something, then you may do things even if that brings unhappiness to others. If you are detached, non-attached means you are not attached to the results. You are not obsessed with the results, beneficial results of your actions, consequence of your actions, then you won't do anything wrong for others. So that's an interesting thing. So the yogi is also equally efficient and successful, but is totally non-attached. The other hand, an ordinary person without practice, without knowledge of yoga, who is not practicing karma yoga, who is efficient, he is doing all this, but is obsessed with results due to extreme attachment. So, Swami Vivekananda once mentioned, you know, all immorality is rooted in selfishness, which is a kind of attachment. cruelty. Mommy, cruelty. That's a sense in which Swamiji used. All evil actions. See, no one can say, I'm doing evil things, but I'm unselfish. You can do that. If you're totally unselfish, you cannot do anything evil. So every evil action is rooted in selfishness. And selfishness manifests in the form of extreme attachment, obsessive attachment towards the beneficial results of what you do. That's the reason.
We spoke of dharma. There's sarva-dharma, correct? Sarva-dharma?
Sarva-dharma.
Correct. Excuse me for my Sanskrit. Then there's a cosmological dharma. There's a responsibility not only for our own personal dharmas, but there's a dharma greater.
Yeah.
So we basically, as a species, are a microcosmic reflection of a macrocosmic dharma.
Yeah.
So in that unity, what is the best attitude to reach that unity?
Yeah. You know, yes, when we do our duty in our interaction, when we really practice our dharma, it will not be in conflict with the dharma of the whole creation. So there will be harmony and integrity. There will be the total freedom from conflict is one important aspect of a spiritually enlightened person. Total freedom from conflict. Conflict also is rooted, as I mentioned, in attachment. So when we reach that level, our dharma will become part of the cosmic dharma, which is technically called by the word ritam in Vedic language. Ritam means there is a universal regulating principle, integrating, harmonizing, regulating principle. It functions in so many different ways. Even at the physical level, see, if you cut trees, you cause deforestation, it leads to shortage of rainfall, famine. So what you call climate, the crisis of climate change, the crisis of ecological imbalance, polluting the earth, polluting the air, all these. Even our physical actions, when we do this, we are actually violating these principles of macro or cosmic balance, which is technically called by the Rigveda, the word rhythm. So rhythm is an invisible, regulating, harmonizing principle. And if you follow the rhythm, then it'd be good for human beings, good for nature, good for other species, and it'd be good for all. That's the aspect of sarva dharma, really speaking.
And then the drawback would be adharma.
Yeah, every violation of this will be adharma, the opposite of it. So, for example, falsehood is an adharma. So the philosophical dimension of this rhythm is called satyam, means truthfulness. And the practical dimension is called dharma. And this universal regulating principle, that aspect is called rhythm. So rhythm, satyam, dharma, these three principles, which are mentioned in Vedic literature, they constitute the universal and also individual, the macro and also micro dimension of cosmic oneness and integrity and harmony.
This would be the ultimate yoga.
Ultimate? The ultimate good, let us say. Yeah, right. So thank you. Now we will continue this discussion tomorrow again, 10 to 11:30, and then 11:30 to 12 refreshments, 12 to 12:30 meditation, and then at 12:30 the retreat ends. So thank you. So tomorrow we'll continue at 10 o'clock here at the same hall. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.